the 1970s and 80s, West Indies cricketers were the gods of the game. Brilliant, charismatic, cool. Everyone wanted to see them play, including white South Africans in the days of apartheid, and when there was a boycott on sporting teams going there. Well, a bunch of rebel West Indian players did tour South Africa in the early 1980s. It changed their lives, not for the better.
Their stories have never been told before, and that's what I wanted, was to get their stories out there to the wider world, and so that they could see how this really complex issue had impacted on their lives.
Well, they were banned from playing cricket for life, and they remain unforgiven. We'll hear more about why they did it and the consequences later here on Sporty. Hello, I'm Amanda Smith. Well, as civil tension and protest has become so intense in the USA, we're returning now to another period of racial controversy where sport became a central player in the drama. For 20 years, from 1971, South Africa was banned from international sport for its regime of apartheid. But in the 1980s, there was a series of rebel cricket tours to South Africa, including teams from Australia and England and the West Indies. Ashley Gray is an Australian cricket writer who spent years tracking down the 20 West Indies players who went to South Africa in the early 1980s to try to understand why they'd done it and the ramifications for them. The result is a book called The Unforgiven. Ashley, what started you off on this?
Well, I was in the West Indies in 2003 and I was reporting for Inside Cricket, and we were in Jamaica and there was a one-day international there at Savannah Park. And after the game ended, me and a friend got a taxi back to the hotel. Just got talking to the taxi driver and he said, "Oh, so you're Australian." I remember all the Australian test cricketers and from the past, you know, he was talking about World Series cricket. And he said, "Do you remember a guy called Richard Austin?" And I said, "Yeah, I have vague recollection of him." And he played a couple of tests, didn't he, in the West Indies side. And he said, "Well, yeah, you can find him." And I said, "Well, where is he?" And he said, "Oh, he'll be begging on the street outside this sort of pastry shop in a place called Crossroads in Middle Kingston." And he said, "I can take you there now."
Well, now that is both, I guess, a shocking and kind of enticing piece of information to have been given. Before we go further into the story of Richard Austin and others among those rebel players, though, let's just do a bit more of the background. Why did any of these rebel cricket tours happen at all in the 1980s, Ashley, given the international sports boycott against South Africa?
Well, it all came down to a government that wanted to present a happy face to the world and show that South Africa was a normal society where international cricketers, international sportsmen and women could come and play their sports and enjoy it. And the first tour was an English tour. They managed to get the likes of Geoffrey Boycott, Graham Gooch, who was still at the prime of his career, but that just shows you how good the money was they were offering, and John Embury, Alan Knott. These are all great names in English cricket. That was a success in the sense that crowds came to see the English team play against their white South African side, the Springboks. But then they wanted the best team in the world. They wanted to get the West Indies. The West Indies were the all-conquering side. They had charisma. They were athletic in a way that other teams weren't. They had a fearsome pace battery. They were the ones that would be a massive coup for the SACU, the South African Cricket Union, of which Ali Bakker was a prime mover, and also Joe Pominski, who was the president. They preyed on guys in the cricket world who had either come towards the end of their career or who were on the fringes, and guys who were desperate for money.
We should mention too that at this time, Nelson Mandela is still in prison and the African National Congress is banned. And the reason why the two West Indies rebel tours are perhaps the most hauntingly significant of any of the teams that went to South Africa at this time is that the players were black, that they were descendants of African slaves taken to the Caribbean.
Yes, yes, they were heading to a country that was systematically discriminating against people of their own race. So you can imagine the uproar in sections of the Caribbean at the time, especially in a place like Jamaica, which in 1957 led the world in a trade ban against South Africa. Yeah, so Afro-Caribbean men going to South Africa was something that upset the majority of the Caribbean. And in South Africa as well, the black organizations, black liberation organizations that were allowed to function, said that they wanted no part of it, and they said no normal sport in an abnormal society.
The other thing, of course, is too that the West Indies cricket success in the 70s and 80s on the world stage was regarded in the Caribbean as a kind of symbol of liberation from that enslaved past.
Yes, that's true. Cricket in the West Indies had almost moved in parallel with politics, in that up until 1961, there was no black captain of the West Indies side. The authorities in the British West Indies didn't want a black man captaining the West Indies, because that would, symbolically at least, it would show, perhaps on a political level, that a West Indian man of colour could lead as well. But what happened in 61 was that the West Indies captain, Frank Worrell, ascended. And at the same time, independence was granted to Jamaica, then a few years later to Guyana and Barbados and Trinidad. Yeah, there'd always been this sort of symmetry between cricket and politics in the Caribbean.
Well, now, the player who captained both the 82-83 and 83-84 West Indies rebel teams was Lawrence Rowe. He was a great batsman in the 1970s, probably past his best by 1982. Why did he sign up to play in South Africa?
Well, Rowe, as you say, was an icon in the West Indies. There's a quote from Frank Worrell's father-in-law where he says that it was as if God seemed to have put a bat in Rowe's hand and said to him, "Go forth and bat." It was just so beautiful to watch. And that's why he still has this status in the Caribbean, probably more so on the other islands than in Jamaica. And so when he accepted Ali Bakker's invitation to captain the side to South Africa, there was a massive backlash, a massive uproar in the Caribbean.
Why did he say yes?
Well, as you said to me, I mean, the money was very tempting. He was offered $150,000, which was more than 100 times what the average Jamaican would expect to earn in a year. So there was the money. There was also this idea that by going, he and his teammates would be able to put a crack in the racist wall, which is a quote from Arthur Ashe, who went there in 1973.
The African-American tennis player.
Yes, and so he thought that by being in South Africa and showing both the white population and black population that black sportsmen could compete on the same level as white sportsmen and even beat them would hopefully open up minds in a way that they hadn't been opened before. That's what he said to me. And I mean, people obviously rationalize things in hindsight, but certainly some of his quotes from the time seem to suggest that that was what he was thinking.
Well, ever since playing there, Lawrence Rowe has basically lived in exile in Florida. So for decades, he's lived in Florida. Has there ever been any rapprochement? You know, has Jamaica forgiven him? Has he expressed any contrition or change of mind about the rights and wrongs of going there?
For the most part, he is still a pariah in his homeland. And what happened in 2011 was that a friend of his on the JCA, the Jamaica Cricket Association board, wanted his name put up on a pavilion at Sabina Park, which is the home of West Indies cricket. So it would have been the Lawrence Rowe Pavilion.
So this was a real act of, well, as I mentioned, rapprochement, I suppose.
Yes, yes, it was. It was bringing him back into the fold. It was saying that we have forgiven you and that you were a fine batsman and the records that you created in many cases still stand. He came back from Miami for the ceremony. He read an apology, which he told me he didn't really agree with, but he did anyway. But then in a radio interview the following day, he said that he thought that in maybe, you know, 20, 50 years, the West Indian rebels would be considered in a better light, that they would be thought of as liberators in that they helped South Africa on its road to ending apartheid. And he cited a Jamaican hero, Paul Bogle, from the 1800s, who had incited revolts against British rule and who was a national hero. And this was heard on radio, and people objected to him making the comparison between his rebels and a Jamaican hero and putting them on the same level. And from that moment on, a concerted campaign was put in place to have his name stripped from the pavilion. And ultimately it was. And Lawrence told me that that was the most humiliating thing that has ever happened to him. And he tried to pursue court action against the JCA, but nothing really came of it. But it just shows you, this is only 9 years ago, and that was 27 years after the last tour, just how passionate people still are about this issue and how it still affects their lives.
You're listening to Sporty with Amanda Smith and Ashley Gray, the author of Unforgiven, about the rebel West Indian cricketers who toured apartheid South Africa between 1982 and 1984. Ashley, at the time of the tours, did the West Indies players, any of them, experience anything of the reality of what life was like for black people in South Africa at the time?
It was more of a bubble that they were in, and they knew that as well. They weren't unaware of what was going on in South Africa. But they were able to go to areas that regular South Africans of colour weren't allowed to go to. They were able to go to bars, to international hotels. Yeah, I mean, they were honorary whites in practice. They were having parties in the hotel rooms, and that they were fraternizing with white women. There was a lot of crazy stuff going on that I don't think P.W. Botha, President P.W. Botha, and his colleagues in the nationalist government at the time would have approved of. But this was the unreal world that the West Indian rebels occupied in South Africa at the time.
Mind you, one of the rebel players, Colin Croft, one of those incredible West Indies fast bowlers who you think of along with Joel Garner and Michael Holding, he did directly encounter racial discrimination on one occasion.
He did indeed, yes. He was taking a train and he sat in a carriage that he didn't realise was reserved for white people only. And the conductor came up to him and asked him to move to a black carriage. There was a white guy on the train who tried to intervene on Colin's behalf and explained to the conductor that, in fact, Colin was an esteemed cricketer, had been invited to South Africa, and he should be allowed to sit where he wants to on the train. But the conductor was adamant, and Colin was removed and put in another carriage. At least that's one version of the story, but basically, yeah, Colin Croft was not allowed to sit where he wanted to because of the colour of his skin. And this became an international story, and in some sectors of the Caribbean media, it was met with glee because they thought, wow, Colin Croft and the rebels are finally getting to see what the real South Africa is and how much of a dream world they've been living in, divorced from reality.
Well, let's come back to the player who started you down the path of tracking down these players. That's Richard Austin. Did you find him as the taxi driver in Kingston said you would?
Yes, we did. We found him. He was literally in the gutter, sitting in the gutter. And, his eyes were bloodshot and, you know, he'd been supping from a plastic bottle of rum. He wanted money to go and buy some cocaine. And there's a line in the book where I say that it was as if in the gutter where no man dare judge another, that he only really felt at home. And I think this was the case with him. He had been to South Africa with the rebels and he'd come back and he had experienced such ostracism. Despite having all this money that he made, he was no longer allowed to play even club cricket. And cricket was his lifeblood, and all of a sudden his life had spiraled out of control. And this is what he was telling me, you know, while we were in the gutter there. But he had this funny little demand. He wanted me, this is 2003, just as sort of mobile phones are kind of coming in, but he said to me, would you be able to call up my good friend Kerry Packer and ask him if I can come over next week and coach the New South Wales side and also play for them? Richard was 48 at the time. And he was very adamant that Kerry, his good friend, would be happy for him to come back to New South Wales and, his future was going to be secure. But it shows you how the sort of tragic sort of humour that he could employ as well. But I just thought at that time, wow, there's a bigger story hear about South Africa and how these rebel tours had impacted on people. And if it had done that to Richard Austin, it must have had consequences for the other guys as well. And what I found over time was, because Richard died in 2015, but the thing about him was that, to me, he sort of held a mirror to Jamaica's own moral consciousness. Because as a young sportsman from the ghetto area of Jonestown, he was fated for transcending his poor background. And then as a former test cricketer who took money to play in South Africa, money that was considered blood money, he was shunned and scorned for visiting a country that practiced a modern form of slavery. And finally, then as a middle-aged vagrant, he was tolerated and humoured. And then when his funeral took place, everyone that spoke was contrite and they felt that they had let Richard down and people felt shame in the way that they had treated him. Yeah, it was a very sad story and just showed you how much these tours had impacted on players' lives.
Of all the cricketers of the West Indies who were approached to play in South Africa on those two rebel tours in the early 1980s, why then did some say no and some say yes? I mean, people like Joel Garner were approached and said no. Others, you know, these 20 whose stories you tell said yes. Was it purely a matter of how strongly principled each individual was?
Well, I think the people that did say no would like you to think that. They probably did think that to some extent. But in many cases, the West Indies Cricket Board had looked after them and they had big futures in West Indies cricket ahead of them, or they were already icons of the game who would no doubt get jobs with West Indies cricket after it. So the people that said no, like Michael Holding and Vivian Richards and Clive Lloyd, had noble reasons for saying no. There's no question about that. But as Roland Butcher, who was the first black man to play for England, told me, he said, and he was born in Barbados and lives there now, but he said, these guys were scathing about the rebels, but the question would be, had they been in a similar position to the others, would they be so scathing? They were coming from a privileged background. If they'd been in the same situation and taken the same stance, that would have been fantastic. But we will never know. So, yeah, there was also Desmond Haynes and Malcolm Marshall, who were reputed to have signed on but then dropped out at the last minute. I think everyone was tempted. Malcolm Marshall was. He writes in his autobiography, Amanda, that he was offered $1 million by Ali Bakker to go on the second tour of apartheid South Africa, but he said no. But once again, he had just clinched his place in the West Indies side and he was part of the new fearsome foursome that would batter the batsmen around the world for the next decade. And thank God he did say no, because he became one of the greatest test bowlers, fast bowlers ever in the history of the game. But you can see that throughout this story, there's never any issue where it's easy to rule one way or the other or come down on the side of one person's argument or the other.
Well, it does make you think, though, what would you do if you were in some kind of equivalent situation, I suppose. Ashley Gray is a cricket writer, the author of Unforgiven, about the 20 West Indian cricketers who decided to defy the international sporting boycotts and play in South Africa in the early 1980s, then a pariah state for its apartheid regime. Ashley, it's good to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us here on Sporty.
Thank you. What I just want to say before we go is that the guys that I spoke to, they all wanted their stories out there. And this is the thing, their stories have never been told before. And that's what I wanted, was to get their stories out there to the wider world and so that they could see how this really complex issue had impacted on their lives. So thanks so much.
And Sporty is produced by Damien Rabbit. I'm Amanda Smith.